When you enter the historical wing of the Israel Museum in Jerusalem, the first thing that meets your eye is a floor-to-ceiling, blown-up photograph of an Egyptian tomb painting. The scene depicted is of the Pharaoh seated upon the throne. His generals bring before him four soldiers captured in battle. Each of the soldiers represents another Asian race. The third is broad-shouldered, tall, bearded Hebrew. And below the painting there is this inscription: Israel is wasted. His seed is no more. Then you walk on and turn the corner, and you come into a museum filled with the glories of 30 centuries of high Jewish history. The Pharaoh Menephtah believed that he had squashed our people even before our history had begun. And since that day, we have outlived every tyrant and every oppressor, and we have confounded that law of history which says that as to men, so to nations, there is an inevitable cycle of birth and youth, maturity, age, and death. Here we are, and by every rule of history, we simply ought not be. What is the explanation of this strange survival of our people? Faith offers one explanation. Abraham, for his obedience and for his loyalty, was rewarded with an eternal covenant, a pact everlasting made with him and with his seed. The faith assumes that God is the protector and that he specially safeguards and vouchsafes the passage of Israel through history. The guardian of Israel neither slumbers nor does he sleep. It assumes that whenever we reach one of those tipping points, when life becomes too difficult and the challenge too high, before we go under, God somehow reaches out and buoys us up and sets us again on our feet. Be of good cheer, O my people. Thou hast been sold unto the nations, but not for destruction. Such is the explanation of the faith, but unfortunately, taken literally, it cannot be substantiated or supported. Today's Purim, we read together the joyous story of the reprieve of the Jews of Shushan from that terrible sentence of genocide. In Persia, the days of the Jews were changed, miyagon l'simcha, me'eva l'yom tov, from sorrow to gladness, from mourning to celebration. But by a quirk of the calendar, today is also Easter, a joyous festival to our neighbors, the festival of the Christ risen, reborn. But for 1,000 years, this weekend between Good Friday and Easter was anything but a happy, carefree time for our people. It was at this time that the church rehearsed to the faithful the story of the crucifixion. And many was the time that a fervid congregation poured out of the church, its eyes flaming red, determined to kill the pious descendants of the Christ killers. God has protected the Jews, and many times he has not protected our people. There are many Purims, not just one. There are many stories in our history of unexpected relief, reprieve. Here's the thing about Purim is that it is a holiday which divides and becomes one and then a second and then a third. Many communities had their own Megillah, their own scroll of a miraculous deliverance. The place is Saragossa, Aragon, Spain. The time is the middle of the 14th century. The occasion is the anniversary of the king's coronation. It was the Aragonese monarch's custom to make a circuit, a procession in his capital on his coronation day anniversary. And as he came to each neighborhood, he received the fealty and the homage of the alcaldes, of the nobles. And they gave him a gift, and they brought with them the relics from their churches as symbol of their loyalty. And when he came to the Al-Yaman, to the Jewish quarter, he was met there by the leading Jewish notables, and they gave him a gift, and they brought with them those magnificent gilded Torah cases, which are the glory of the Spanish synagogue. Instead of putting their scrolls of the Torah in an ark such as we do, each scroll was encased in a beautifully embossed box cabinet. But some noxious fellow had told the king that the Jews mocked him. They brought empty boxes. They called him empty-headed. There was no Torah in the case. And indeed, such was the fact. Over many years' experience, the Jews had learned that to carry these cases in the procession was to fray the parchment, to rip the binding, to tear the sewing, and so they had gotten in the habit of leaving the scrolls behind in the synagogues. The king this particular day was determined to see if, in fact, the Jews were mocking him. He would order the cases opened. He came to the Al-Yaman. He stood before the heads of the Jewish community and demanded that the Torah cases be opened. In fear and trembling, they were opened, and lo and behold, the Torahs were in their case. That night, the night before, the Shamas, the beadle of the synagogue, had had a dream. And he had heard a voice in that dream, and the voice had told him to leave the scrolls that day in the ark. And so in Saragossa, in the middle of the 14th century, their anguish was turned to celebration. And Saragossa, for the rest of its Jewish history, had its own Purim. And you will find this all written in its Megillah. There have been miraculous deliverances. But 100 years later, the selfsame community of Saragossa was faced with the frightful choice of exile, baptism, or death. Within 100 years, it was no more. The faith taken literally cannot be substantiated or supported. And the guardian of Israel, if he guarded us fully, would have seen to it that by today we were not a mere 12 million minority in a world population of some 2 billion, but by the simple laws of progeny, we would be today the vast majority, the preponderance of mankind. Many have died. Many have fallen by the wayside. Now what have we done if we have smashed the ancient piety? Have we come any closer to a solution to the riddle of Jewish survival? But here is a stubborn fact. We are. How do we explain it? Assume if we must that we celebrate Purim because it's the exception rather than the rule. That if deliverance were the rule, there would be no reason for this celebration. Except that many have died. We have lost perhaps a majority of our people. How yet do we explain the miracle of Jewish survival? Now, historians come to our aid with one explanation. It seems reasonable. It is compelling because it seems to be full of common sense. They say that Israel has survived because we were a scattered people, because of the dispersion. We never had all our eggs in one basket, and so all of our heads could not be cracked by one tyrant. But is this a sufficient explanation of the survival of Israel? In the first century of the Common Era, there were Gnostics, men who followed the mystery cults, in every community from Gibraltar to the gates of India. In every community where you found Jews, you found these devotees of the various mystery cults. The Jews are, and they are no more. The simple fact of dispersion does not explain survival. It is part of the technique of survival, the strategy of survival, perhaps. But had we not something to shore us up, to keep us going, to enliven and inspirit us, Israel would not be here today despite the dispersion. Well, then, have we survived? The problem which we face is a simple one. When we accept the ancient pieties, we do so flat out, literally. We assume that God must operate as man operates. If we were given the task of protecting the people, what we would do? What would we do? We would build high battlements. We would burrow deep into the ground. We would find a deterrent armor. We would use weapons, armament, troops. We would try to shield those whom we protect and guard from their enemies. And would it avail us? Have the arms races of mankind and the high walls of the ancient castles, have the Maginot lines of modern man ever protected a people from its enemies? God's ways are not our ways, and his thoughts are not our thoughts. I love the line in Isaiah. It says, La'asot ma'asehu, zar ma'asehu. God goes about his work, but his work is strange to the human mind. We assume that he must react as we would react, when in fact he follows his own deeper and higher wisdom. I do not pretend to know how God has brought about the miracle of Jewish survival, but I am tempted to believe that it has something to do with the spirit, with the faith, that God gave us the secret of survival at Sinai when he gave us a faith which we could never achieve, when he revealed to us himself a God who can never be fully comprehended, when he insisted that we must abide a rule, a discipline which will always escape our attaining it. The rule in Judaism is not respectability, but righteousness. We are not told to be judicious, but to be ambitious for the right. We are not told to give charity, but to walk uprightly. There is always a demand resting upon us which we have not yet met, for what are we demanded to do by our ethic? To emulate God. And no man ever achieves the dimensions of the divine. As I am holy, be thou holy. As I am just, be thou just. As I am righteous, be thou righteous. As I am kindly, be thou kindly. Judaism is a foolish faith. Foolish because it imposes upon us demands beyond our competence. And yet I submit that this very folly is wisdom, and indeed that it is the spirit which has permitted our survival. I look about me. When does a man or a woman age? They age when life loses purpose. When each day is a routine, for which there is no meaning. You're simply dragging yourself along without knowing the why or the wherefore. And when do the days fly by? And when is man at his full strength? It's not a matter of years, of chronology, but when he feels that he is needed, when she feels that she is important to her family, when he knows that the business cannot survive without his talent, when he feels that he has something he must contribute to his profession, then life has meaning, then man has spirit and vigor and vitality, and as with men, so with nations. History is not simply a matter of weapons, technology, of gross populations, of great national economic products, of finance and the like. History was simply a matter of bulk, of force. The Roman Empire would never have fallen. The whole Roman Empire would never have disintegrated. We would have long since have had our way in South Vietnam. But there is a force in history which is spiritual, psychological, human. And it is this that is the real force of man. For no people which believed something deeply was ever crushed by armor. Generations might be destroyed, but ultimately the idea went through. God gave us our immortality at Sinai when he gave us a law, a discipline, a vision, a faith, which could somehow reach into us in every generation and demand of us that folly which is wisdom, that ambition which brings out the youth that is within us. You know the old saw, from rags to riches, from riches to rags in three generations. When it holds true, why does it hold true? The grandfather is no more talented, no better intellectually than his grandson. But he had a purpose. He worked for a reason. He was ambitious. Life had taste for him. He used his energies, and the grandson had only a legacy, only an inheritance, only the responsibility of spending what the grandfather had made. And when there are families like the Adams family or the Rockefeller family who escape this cycle of rags to riches and riches to rags, why do they escape it? Because the sons and grandsons that find in subsequent generations other ideas which marshal their energies, which compel the best that's in them, which renews their youth because it renews their strength, because it gives life purpose. Israel, in largest measure, has survived because we have always had a purpose to live it. We have never been able to achieve what we must achieve. Indeed, we will never achieve it. Man will never be divine. Israel will never be truly a priest people. There will always be more than we can do, and that is the secret of our immortality. Let's speak again of wisdom and folly. Youth is impetuous. Youth is a dreaming age. Youth is ambitious. Youth will not listen to the worldly wise. And Judaism is a religion which speaks to the youth, speaks to all men as if we are young. For we will not allow any of us to settle into satiety and flatulence, middle age, comfortable living. Here's Abraham, happy in his father's home, comfortable. He could easily have climbed the ladder of success in Ur of the Chaldees. And yet he was told by God to do a foolish thing, to seek an unknown faith and an uncertain freedom. How many fathers have told their sons, you know, you can find yourself in Cleveland quite as easily as in New York or in the woods, San Francisco, but God is with the child. And here is Moses, happy tending his father-in-law's flocks, peace with his wife and his family, in the wilderness, without a care in the world. And he was told by God to do an immensely foolish thing. Throw all this up, to go to Pharaoh, to demand that a motley of slaves be freed, and to bring this motley array of people through the wilderness to a promised land. Implausible, impossible, folly. But Moses went. How many of us have the folly to be wise? How many of us, being foolish, will find again our youth? The prophets were fools. They went about the streets of Jerusalem and Samaria castigating perfectly nice people. Good businessmen who gave to charity. Leaders of the community who came regularly to the sacrifices at the temple. And when the fine civic figures of the day, the leaders, came to these prophets and said, Meshuggah Ishanavi, you're Meshuggah, you prophet, what are you doing? These are fine people, why are you castigating them? Everybody has his failings, his mistakes, to be sure, but you can't change human nature, and that's the way it's always going to be. The prophets went out, demanded more, that we'd not be satisfied with all of all the excuses and all of the rationalizations about human nature, because you can change human nature if your sights are high enough, your ideas are profound enough. Theodor Herzl was a Mishumina. He talked about taking a people who've been off of the soil for 1,000 years, taking them back to a blasted, wasted, sandy land, and building there a modern technological state, a Jewish state. And his friends turned to him in absolute dismay. "You're being absolutely paranoid about the whole thing, Herzl. There's no possibility of doing this. You don't own the land. The people will not come. They do not have the skills." The people came. The land became theirs. What's the secret of Jewish survival? The faith. A faith so foolish that it's wise. A faith which asks us to believe in a God who can never be seen. Faith which asks us to achieve a standard, a discipline, which is admittedly beyond each and every one of us. But the very demand that the faith makes on us is our youth. No Jew, unless he be blind and ignorant, no Jew need ever lack a reason for living. No Jew ever need retire. There's always something to be done. There's always a child to be taught. There's always a home which needs your help. There's always a community which needs your advice. There's always some new activity which demands minds such as yours. There's always a service which requires tenderness and love. Now, some Jews resign from Judaism. They come to temple, but they resign from Judaism because they resign from their human responsibilities. They live, but without a reason for living. Nothing impels them. There's no dream anymore. They assume that you must be young to dream. Many of those who have been in their 70s and the 80s have dreamt the dreams of mankind and built the cities of mankind and written the philosophies of mankind and fought the revolutions of mankind. Dreams are not the monopoly of the young. They are the burden of the Jew. And if you want to survive as a human being and as a Jew, be so foolish in your dreams that you are wise in your living. Amen.